Mr. Velasquez, thank you for meeting me. I appreciate it. How long have you been wanting to run for city council?
Well, I've never wanted to run for politics, for political office. I did submit for the appointment, but I wasn't necessarily submitting for, you know, common reasons. I'm a voter in District 3, and you know, I consider myself involved. I wasn't one who accepted the idea that an appointment should be given without some limits to the powers of that appointment. I believe that appointment should have been an interim council position, and it shouldn't have come with the opportunity to run for office, because I'm a strong believer that advantage isn't an advantage over other people running, that it was an advantage over the people voting, because the people have a right when they don't have a representative that's part of that process of representation, right, of the vote, that they have a right to an open and clear election. And council creating an incumbency is to me not right, you know, or it's not the best process to offer the citizens.
So how do you think Ms. Ozuna has done so far?
Obviously I'm running, right? And I'm running because I'm not a fan of the way that people are being represented in the city. Now, my focus is District 3, and I'm just, like many of the voters, don't feel that we're getting represented. Don't feel like we've lost the ability to reach out to our councilperson and knock on that door and get an answer, or call that phone number and get to speak to a councilperson. So I'm 48. I come from a different politic in San Antonio that expects that, you know, we have a relationship with our councilperson, that it's not, you know, kind of that noblesse oblige, you know, but that we're the ones in charge. We the constituents, and the representative works for us.
So I mean, are you expressing, you know, difficulties? Have you ever not gotten to speak to Ms. Ozuna right away? Or
I've had my own like anybody who's involved in the city, we have a regular relationship with our leaders, period. And with regard to the style of leadership in the city right now, in the areas where I have had a need for immediate answer or response, I haven't found that to be something that is available anymore. At the same time, as I've gotten out to speak to other people, I have found that it's a very common thing right now. It's a very common phenomenon, if we want to call it that. That we're simply not seen as the priority.
Who is it? The people?
The constituent.
The constituent.
Or better yet, you know, the person that picks up the phone and calls and expects that you're going to get some kind of a response, or that sets a meeting and is going to expect that meeting is going to be kept, or that they're important, that we're number one.
And are these complaints in general or about Ms. Ozuna?
Well, look, whoever's got the seat in District 3, you know, right now is who those complaints are about. So I would imagine that if nothing changed and there was somebody else there, the complaints would be about whatever that office is. You know, right now our office is District 3, and District 3 is not being responsive. And the answers that are coming back from District 3 to the public is, you know, the councilperson doesn't have time, is busy, it works. This is not the only thing that the councilperson does, you know. And, you know, we need to deepen our commitment to the community. Obviously, running for city council is a sacrifice. It's not just a matter of wanting to be a councilperson. You know, there have been reports in the recent past about, you know, councilpersons talking about not being able to make it financially because of the commitment at city council, all these different things. But this is not new. City council has been around San Antonio for quite some time, and we're leaving a tradition of service to the community, and we're entering into a new shift that is yet to be defined. But most definitely, when you talk to people, there are services that we consider traditionally a part of our expectation. And you know, I don't know in the name of savings or what, more of the burden is shifted to the homeowner or to the resident, and you know, for you know, it really is a great answer to give you, because I know that the people that are listening are going to know exactly what I'm talking about. I'm not talking right now as a person in office or a politician. I'm a taxpayer. I'm a homeowner. I know exactly what my expectations are of my my system, of the taxes that I pay, and I'm not getting any of it. You know, so it's for me, it's a shift that needs to shift back. It needs to go back to our traditional the services that meet our expectations.
How'd you vote on pre-K for SA?
I did not vote for pre-K for SA.
So you voted no?
Yes, okay. I voted no.
Tell me why.
Well, I think that it takes away needed pressure. It takes away needed organizational pressure that really should focus on our independent school districts and their need to meet the needs of those of us that pay, you know, that tax that supports the independent school districts. So if we have a problem with the way that children are educated, then we need to become very proactive. We need to take that energy that was utilized to organize all of those all of the constituents that voted yes, and focus that, use that leadership to stand up and focus our attention to the independent school district that ultimately is going to create that continuous solution that takes them not just from, you know, 4 years old to 18 years old, but that really addresses what we're all saying. What we're all saying is that we think that the educational system needs an overhaul. And if that means that it has to start at 4 years old now, and, you know, we have a lot of young people that are graduating at 17, maybe what's really happened is the educational dynamic has shifted to a different age group. And I think that's fine. I mean, we have to be brave enough to challenge our system and involved enough to go out there and organize those parents and get them to understand that it's okay to have a higher expectation of the educational system. To utilize the system, to utilize our municipal opportunity to duplicate, I mean, it kind of goes against a lot of what we're taught in the, you know, in the community building models, that really one of the worst things you can do is duplicate services. It creates competition that in many cases is not, gets lost in bureaucracy, funding that gets lost in bureaucracy. You know, I mean,
so it's wasteful spending.
It's wasteful spending, but it's to me, philosophically, it's way off mark. We have to be challenging our system, not duplicating it.
Mr. Velasquez, tell me, what's the one thing in District 3 that needs attention right now?
The one thing? Wow, there's a couple of things that equal,
okay,
to the one. The one thing, I guess we all have different philosophies or different perspectives on what the one thing is.
Or are they like a group of things, like you said, on one category? Or
the one thing is a little bunch of things. Proactively, it's the that citizens have an expectation, constituents have an expectation that the city does something for them. Like, for instance, you know, those of us who come from a time when there were dog catchers have the expectation that you pick up 311, you know, of course, back then we didn't have 311, but now we do, that you call 311 and say that there's a pack of dogs running down the street. They have the expectation that a dog catcher is going to go out and catch those dogs. They are shocked when they're told, well, we don't pick up dogs anymore. You have to detain that dog and call us, and then we'll pick up that dog. You know, I mean, you tell that to a 78-year-old, the 78-year-old gets a little shocked. Okay, so that's one real big deal, because dogs are running in packs. Sidewalks. Pick up the phone, you call city, tell them that you got broken sidewalks, and, you know, the common story is that it's heartbreaking to have to go outside and see a senior citizen that's fallen down. We have to look at our sidewalk situation in the South Side as part of a maintenance program, the way we look at streets. That it should not, we should not follow a new process that says that the homeowner's in charge of fixing the sidewalk in front of their house. These really basic things that are part of our everyday quality of life. So there are some very simple shifts that have occurred that I don't know if it's in the name of savings, but most definitely whatever causes these shifts, we need to redefine what our commitment is as a city to the taxpayers who build a city. Now, it's hard to explain to a person why a dog is not picked up or why a sidewalk is their responsibility when they may have just heard about $1 million incentive going to put a grocery store downtown. So while all of this is happening, understanding that we live in a time of very effective mass media, that people are getting information as quickly about the things that are being done in other areas of town as they are having to go outside and pick somebody up. So these things are happening at the same time. It's hard to understand how, you know, we give a large, I don't know, what is it, a $7 million abatement to an organization, or a $12 million abatement to an organization in the South Side that is going to send its profits back to another country. It's hard to get excited about this when the really tiny basic things that are quality of life issues for the people in District 3, it just doesn't make any sense, you know? Now, the other thing is that when we have this void of leadership, which is like a, you know, council people in District 3 have this tradition of vacating their seat before it's over, bringing in someone to fill a position and create an incumbency that really undermines the democratic process. It weakens that seat. And, you know, in this situation, you know, weakened it to a point that we got someone who was appointed who had really, for all practical purposes, you know, or in comparison to most district people, had just moved into the district. And even then moved in from another state and then previously living in San Antonio in a completely different area. That we should have some expectation that we're going to have a leader that knows the South Side very well, instead of one that is just part of a political process that really is more to the benefit of the political group or that dominates power in the South Side. We have high expectations for ourselves over here, and you know, for instance, you know, this big rush to bring I think it's OCI into the South Side, it kind of undermines those high expectations. I have yet to talk to somebody in the South Side that sees us as a manufacturing base for the city of San Antonio. You know, and I think that you have to know the South Side. You have to be part of the collective high expectation, you know, of the people that you meet in the neighborhoods, that, or people that you go to high school with, went to high school with, or whatever, that they want to be doctors, or they want to be lawyers, or they see the South Side capitalizing on a innovative way to draw tourism down here, you know. Bring in an economic that never really existed, and then create that economic and leave the South Side with some good idea that was without the support of District 3. You know, I think that our representative or our appointed representative should have said, you know, I'm appointed and I'll be here for, you know, a couple of months, and after we do the election, then let's talk about how the South Side feels about changing its economic, changing its business base or its commercial base.
Yeah, that's, I mean, like, you know, next along the OCI deal, I mean, what do you think about that?
I mean, you know, First, CPS is obviously looking to invest in that solar panel, the solar power, smart technologies, whatever we want to call it. I think the real important detail about that is that there were different organizations or groups that vied for that opportunity. And clearly, there were organizations that had numbers that were solid and secure numbers. For whatever reasons, we're sold on a corporation that, first and foremost, is not an American investment. And secondly, we're not given all of the data that would support us making a sound decision that allows Southsiders to go to sleep at night knowing that we have the potential that is beginning with good potential. No, right now we're sold on this idea that, well, our numbers are bad. You know, we might have been down $60 million in this quarter and, you know, another $71 million in this other quarter. But we're confident that we're going to make it. Well, you know, Southsiders or District 3 people should have been afforded the opportunity to go to sleep at night knowing that there's a company coming in that if they fail, it's not going to be because, well, we took a company that was being pushed to the limit. Which is exactly what we're doing right now. You know, we have to wonder whether or not they're going to be able to do better than they've done in the past. That's not the way to get into a business deal. It was a bad deal.
Well, you know, I'm from the South Side, too, and, I mean, you know, this all wasn't here when I was growing up. So what do you think about the developments that have been happening around the South Side, and do you think it's bringing a new energy and reinvestment?
I think that this is exactly on the right track. Now, but keeping in mind that, you know, we're looking at a South Side that if you've been around, you know, I'm 48 years old. So I remember when there was a Sound Warehouse down the street over here, a Dillard's. And remember, Dillard's, before all of these other stores came in, Foley's and Macy's, was a big deal. Sears. So for those of us who grew up, you know, riding our bikes down Military Drive and on the trails and the river, this is not so much, wow, look what's possible. It's more I'm glad that we held on because we always knew this. I mean, let me give you something that I think, an example that I think is a very perfect way to look at development on the South Side. I say, forget the $1 million incentive for a grocery store downtown. How about a $1 million incentive for Barnes & Noble to go into Shopper City Mall down the street over here? You know, I don't think that we would get any argument from Barnes & Noble if we put that $1 million up front. The reality is we are being sold on stories that expect us to be excited about another area getting something that we never get. I mean, we're blessed that Brooks did what it did. In the same way that Kelly USA is. You know, I worked at Kelly. I started there. When I got out of Harlandale, I went to work in Building 375 as a machinist before I decided I want to go to design school. To see it change the way that it changed. Oh, sure. I mean, you know, we have great opportunities, great potential for partnerships that can lead to areas like this. I would not have seen 86 acres of prime South Side property in Brook City Base going the manufacturing way. And this whole idea that comes from the appointee that says, you know, opportunities like this come once every 10 years. Well, you know what? I'm almost 50. That means that I've been here a sequence of 5-10 years almost. I would have never tried to sell to the South Side this idea that, hey, we should become the manufacturing base of San Antonio. I mean, I look at the area between District 2 and District 3. If I was going to do manufacturing there's plenty of areas that are not only closer zoned, but already have that type of an industry attitude.
So what is, if it's not manufacturing, what would be your big vision if you're elected?
Well, you know, I hate to let the cat out of the bag, you know, but because we're all in a competition over ideas here, and I come from the architectural background, you know, that idea that you draft your blueprint and put it in a drawer and don't let nobody see it, you know. But you know what, I do want to see us capitalize on existing industries in San Antonio. One industry that, without being too specific, I would love to see our small businesses have the opportunity to draw from the tourist industry. I mean, we have to make up our mind. Are we building on that tourist industry? Or are we, you know, looking to mix and match in ways that that force us to determine, well, who gets what. Well, if I had the opportunity, I would definitely create incentives to pull tourism to the south side, and I don't mean that just in the sense that, well, we have a beautiful river now, and if you're from the south side, then you know that we've always known that river was there, and we've always swam in it and driven in it, and all of that. But I think that the worst case scenario for the south side would be to create an access point that gives people the incentive to stay down there on the river. We need to create reasons for people to draw themselves up from that river.
Give me just one. I mean, I know you don't want to let your plan go, but one thing in that attracting people to the south side, like what could that be? What could that look like?
I want to. The only way to do this is to tell you straight out. I would draw on expanding the convention center.
They're going to do that. They're going to do the expansion of the convention center with the whole, what's the project, Hunt Zachary?
No, I'm talking about draw it to the south side.
Draw the convention center to
Yeah,
the south
side. I would replace the OCI idea with a major convention center expansion to the south side.
So a new facility on the south side.
A completely new facility. And create a competition between downtown and the south side. Now, what does that say for the city as a whole? Well, you know what? My job would be to make a south side that can compete with any part of town. And you know, the other thing is that when you talk to people in the south side, I mean, not to mention that, you know, I have opinions of my own that are really sharing the same opinions. We don't want to see a 1604, North 1604 over here. We don't want to see traffic jams and cookie cutter houses, so we have the opportunity to create an industry that brings people that leave. They come, they spend, they leave, and there's no better San Antonio than the south side of San Antonio. You know, I have a little joke that I've been making for years that, in terms of, you know, trying to sell that south side, is remember that when the Spanish came to San Antonio, they settled on the south side. You know, so we're not the first people, you know, living over here that said, hey, this is the best place in town. This has been happening for hundreds of years. So I think that if we had the opportunity to draw visitors to the south side by virtue of why they're in town, why they're doing business, that we could create a mass transit improvement system that facilitates that movement. We have 281. And they're going to have to eat somewhere, and they're going to have to, you know, people go to conventions, they go to buy things. I mean, I like to think of our Southside core as the retail center of Texas, and with a lot of small San Antonio businesses capitalizing on that. I think that has would have effects on the economy as a whole in San Antonio, but also on people that live in San Antonio, providing jobs, but the kind of jobs that we want, you know, the kind of jobs that are not only give us the opportunity to go work and drive relatively short distances to go home, but that give us the dream of opening up our own business with enough space to do that, and move away from this idea of developing a bigger suburb, you know, base. Another thing, agriculture. I think that the Southside has a great opportunity to build on its on a new era of agricultural development, to get behind those people that maybe can't wait to sell their properties, to get them to reinvest and recommit themselves to a future that there's nothing like for hundreds of miles. That a city that gets behind an organic agricultural system, a lot of ideas can be very long term, but with this extended council limit to 8 years, I think that a lot is possible now, and it's so critical that we take advantage of that opportunity to not elect a person that is going to look at the city as business as usual, but that is going to be able to look at the south side as an opportunity to build on what we know and love about it. And I feel very blessed to have had such a nice career in architectural work and vision planning and having done process work with the city of San Antonio as a pro bono urban design professional, from master plans to the South Central master plan to the downtown strategic master plan. I was a neighborhood commercial revitalization coordinator that led to the development of the guidelines that would be used in Southtown and on Blanco and Prospect Hill and Avenida Guadalupe and all these other methods that not only teach us how we organize and facilitate community around visions, but also what are the most efficient ways to mobilize the planning department, the architectural department, the engineering department of the city of San Antonio.
So there was a commission that you were?
No, several master plans. When the city does a master plan, it reaches out to the urban design community. And I've always been fortunate enough to be there with some of the top leaders in the urban design world here in San Antonio. And to have...
So like I say, you're on the master planning committees.
All the way back to the last city of San Antonio strategic plan. I don't know if that was 1996 or 97. It was sometime back.
And just real quickly, I wanted to get a profile. So you said you're 48, you went to Harlandale, you worked at Kelly USA as a machinist, you went to design school, so you're an architect.
I'm a designer. I think I'm supposed to say I'm a candidate for architectural licensing because I had started taking the test, but I went to San Antonio College and then I went to UTSA.
Okay, so...
got a degree from the architecture school at UTSA.
And that was in, what was your degree in?
Architecture.
Okay, so you're a designer and... Do you own your own business now? Or?
I own my own business. I did Green Vegetarian. I did the 527 Dewey, which is the Casa Rosa that was kind of is seen as the catalyst for the Tobin Hill revitalization. People buying in because of that pink house.
you did that? Or
I designed it.
Designed that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's simple, but it's a nice geometric statement.
Yeah.
I'm designing with Jesse Trevino the Veterans Monument at Emmendorf Lake, which is really a more kind of visionary sculptural architectural piece. I'm a product of the South Side. Look, I DJ'd as a kid, and then I ended up being the jazz program director at KSYM. Started at KRTU. I'm just very fortunate to have been able to hone out the things that were important to me, you know.
Well, do you think, I mean, because I haven't seen Rebecca Villagran's name down, so I don't know, but tomorrow's a deadline, so we'll see if she gets in the race because she wanted the appointment like Councilwoman Azuna did.
Mm-hmm.
Do you consider yourself the underdog, or do you think you have a good chance in this race?
I consider the underdog the voters because, you know, I have the data of how we vote, and we're not voting. And when I look at the numbers, I realize that the people are voting in the presidential election, and they're making a conscious decision not to vote in the city council election. And when you go around and you knock on doors and you talk to people, they tell you exactly why they're not voting. They're not voting because they have no confidence in the people that are running. So the numbers that you see, we shouldn't be surprised. As a matter of fact, the only way to look at the voter apathy in District 3 is to look at the voter record in the presidential election, so that we know that it's not apathy, it's protest. They can't stand what's happening. And you know, I'm not trying to make a parallel of anything. I'm only running because I am not going to vote for these two people. And if I'm not going to vote for them, I have to vote. I'm a cheerleader for voting. So how am I not going to vote? This situation puts me in the position to say that, well, this is the kind of thing that causes... It's a surprise to me, too, because I was mentored by Albert Pena, who's pushing everybody to get involved in the political process, and I rejected it.
So, I mean, so you've been an active voter in the past?
I vote in every election, okay. You know?
Did you vote... Let's see here. Ms. Ramos. Did you vote for Ms. Ramos?
I voted for Ms. Ramos, okay. Yes. Okay. That's one of the reasons why I'm so disappointed in people continuing that tradition of vacating the seat to run after their own personal ambition. It's like we have a commitment to us. They take an oath, you know. What's this? You know, well, I got to go now. I'm going to go run for somebody for a higher seat. That's a bad tradition.
Well, I mean, so, but do you have a chance in this election?
I think I do. I'm from the area. I'm an organizer. I'm a mobilizer. I have.
Do you have signs up yet and all that?
Just started putting them up. Got the signs day before yesterday. I designed the sign, it's an exciting thing for me. You know, I'm really hoping that one of the reasons that people aren't voting is because they want a commitment to being represented, not a commitment to getting somebody in office and then having them tell us what we need. You know, one of the things that is very clear across the board, 100%, nobody agreed with the 8.4% hike in the SAWS. No one. And that's an example of how things are being pushed to us, and no one is setting up any clear process for informing us or getting our opinions. We are being told what is going to happen, and that is what's causing people to not vote, which is really causing us to become, I mean, sure, the voters are doing it to themselves by not participating. They have no voice. They have no defense. I mean, we get what we deserve. But at the same time, and they'll tell you too, that voter apathy, it's not just voter apathy. It's also candidate apathy. People don't want to run. They're afraid. You know, they're not only afraid Well, let's just say that they're afraid of being vilified. So there's all kinds of reasons why people are not running in San Antonio, which is really only creating a stronger city manager model than a stronger than strengthening the representative model. And we got to get back to at least a 50-50, where that tug of war, where we have champions there that are willing to play that tug of war.
And family, do you have family?
Yes. No, it's just my wife and I, okay. and our kids are our commitment to the community. Yeah.
Okay, so no children, but your wife, and what's your wife's name?
Her name's Jennifer.